6. And then in 516, the Israelites came back and built the second temple on that same spot. And then what happened to that one, you know?
That was destroyed in about 72 AD, wasn't
it? 70 AD. That one was destroyed by not an earthquake,
the Romans.
Not fire from heaven,
the Romans.
Yeah, just after Jesus' death. And actually, that was the third temple because Herod dismantled parts of the second temple and built an even more elaborate temple in that same place. This is actually a third one that they call the second temple. So this was destroyed in 70 AD. And I just want to mention that on that sheet I handed out yesterday that some of you got, there were a long parable based on Lamentations. And it was a reinterpretation of Lamentations to make it less devastating. And Israel went through a cultural crisis when the temple was destroyed. You can imagine. Has God rejected his people? And that's the way Christians interpreted that event. Tertullian, one of the early church fathers, said the Jews were being punished for their sins and the inheritance has passed to the Christians. They lost it. And this cultural crisis, they responded to by telling stories, by telling Meshalim, trying to reconcile the events of history with Torah, which told them that they were God's elect people. That's just a sidelight. Anyway, this temple, as you can see, is a map. And these different numbers, you might not be able to see all of this, but this is the Holy of Holies in here, right? And this is a holy place right in front of that. Now, the Levites could not go into the Holy of Holies. Only the priests could do that. This is a sort of porch, an entranceway in that. All these special secret doors, you know, gates and curtains. And then, I forget what this is. Oh, yeah, this is an altar, right, in front of there. And then over here, you have the place, the court for the priests. And down a little farther away from the holy place, you have the court for the men of Israel. Back off to the third row, please. Anybody know what this part is over here?
The
door.
Women's court.
And the gallery up here. I think it's interesting in this diagram that this is a reconstruction, of course, by a scholar that I got out of a biblical dictionary. I think it's interesting that this women's court is so large. I don't know what that means.
They even have the children with them.
Oh, thank you. That's the big one. And then this is, you know, this part is out here. The court of the Gentiles, according to the diagram. So you can see that this is not just a religious map or a structure for worship, it's also a social map or a map with social indicators built into it. Now, in Jesus' lifetime, this temple, of course, was still standing. And you might remember that one of the charges brought against him, the chief charge in Mark and Matthew, was that the temple that Jesus had said, the temple, that he would destroy the temple. And that was brought against him. In John, Jesus answers his accusers and immediately says, I taught openly in the temple. You all know what I said. So Jesus was teaching in the temple. Now, if we go back to the Pharisee and the publican story, Luke doesn't say where Jesus taught this parable. There may be some theories about this. I don't know about them. But if you just look at Luke, it doesn't say all of a sudden there he is talking to people possibly in Jerusalem. But wouldn't it be amazing if he told that parable in the temple? Just think of the impact of that. When he says the tax collector goes down to his house justified, he throws away the temple map. I like to remember something that a friend of mine and one of the Holden sages, the Lutheran sages, Walt Bowman, I think it was, said this, that the root word for Jesus is something that means to be given a large space, to be delivered from a tight corner, to be given running room. And when these men go down to their houses and one is justified, gracious space opens up in the story, where before there was sacral enclosure and sacralized difference. Now, that story, I think, does more than more than give us examples of good behavior. And one reason for that is the Pharisee doesn't do anything. He doesn't do anything. He's a beat his breast. It's only action in the story. Whereas the publican doesn't do anything. The Pharisee says what he did, and presumably wouldn't lie to God. He probably did do those things. But the publican doesn't do anything. Jesus doesn't give us a sequel where the publican jumps up like a cured leper and says, "I found it." You know, in the chapter right before this, the leper is cured, and that leper, by the way, is a Samaritan. Jesus doesn't give us that kind of sequel. He doesn't exactly tell us what to do. The emphasis is more on what God does. And if you want to take a quick look at this, it's in Luke 18 at the very end of this story. Verse 14. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. That's where I'm ending the parable. And then Luke says, for everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but he who humbles himself will be exalted. That's Luke's moral. Now what that does, it seems to me, is it kind of narrows down the meaning to individual behavior. Not that individual behavior isn't important, and not that this is wrong. It seems to me the parable opens up a larger vision than that, and not just about individual behavior. And one of the things that struck me when I was reading this the other night is that there's a kind of echo of another passage in Luke here. Can you think what that might be? Any of you who know Luke? He who exalts himself will be humbled, but he who humbles himself is exalted. Take a look in Luke 1. Luke 1, verse 46. You know this. My soul magnifies the Lord, and my spirit rejoices in God my Savior, for he has regarded the low estate of his handmaiden, for behold, henceforth all generations will call me blessed. Blessed? Who is speaking here? Very lowly person. For he who is mighty has done great things for me, and holy is his name. And his mercy is on those who fear him from generation to generation. He has shown strength with his arm. He has scattered the proud in the imagination of their hearts. He has put down the mighty from their thrones and exalted those of low degree. That's the passage I was thinking of. He has filled the hungry with good things, and the rich he has sent empty away. He has helped his servant Israel in remembrance of his mercy as he spoke to our fathers, to Abraham and to his posterity forever. Now, how is this different from the moral of the story of the Pharisee and the publican? It echoes it, or the other echoes this. But what's the difference? About what Mary is saying and what Luke puts at the end of that parable. Is there more here?
Would it be the fact that Mary is bringing in something about the country of Israel and the promise that was made to Abraham?
She does end with that, that's right. Now that's here, and that's not another story. In fact, that other story overturns that in a way. Mm-hmm. It doesn't say it's true exactly, but it does suggest that the temple map part of it is not anymore.
It's
populated.
A contrition or contrite heart that Mary exposes here, I think, which is a little bit different than the parable. The contrite heart.
Okay. Anybody else see anything more in here than in the idea if you humble yourself, you'll be exalted? And if you exalt yourself, you'll be humbled. That total reversal. That's it. But there's something more, I think. Isn't there a kind of prophetic vision of a new order of things in this? There's a lot more mentioned. For one thing, she says, he has put down the mighty from their thrones. That's talking about kings and powerful people, isn't it?
she's a lot further.
She's filled the hungry with good things. What?
She's a lot further along in her spiritual life, so to speak, than either one of these in chapter 18. So she's gone way to the women, you know. They've gone way beyond the two hymns.
Luke might agree with that. This is kind of like an overture to Luke in a way, you know, like an overture to a symphony, striking many of the themes that he's going to strike in his gospel and that are also in many of the parables.
Where had she been told that all generations would call her blessed?
I assume the Holy Spirit. Mm-hmm. Now, actually, this wonderful poem, prophetic poem that she's speaking here in Luke, very closely echoes the Song of Hannah in Samuel. Mm-hmm. And she's being identified with that other mother of a great leader. So that's part of what's being done here in the gospel. But there's this line of prophetic women who see the vision of this larger change society. And it's not just a vision of God loves everyone, and that's nice and that's true. It includes a word of judgment along with its word of mercy and grace, which is harder for us to hear.
The Jewish people had waited so long for a Messiah.
Yeah.
And so I'm sure that she was well schooled in all the glory, I guess, that would surround him. Mm-hmm. And she was overwhelmed by the fact that she was to be the mother of this Messiah. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that that's the reason she said, all generations will call me blessed.
Yes. And the emphasis here is on God's power very much, isn't it? In the ending of the Pharisee and the publican story, it's almost like tit for tat. You humble yourself and you'll be exalted. I mean, I know people like that, and maybe that thought has crossed my mind before, that if I act more humble, you know, in the end I'm going to be rewarded. That's not her vision, really. Something different than that, something more. Now let me turn back to you and put you on the spot for a minute. What kind of parable could we make out of the Pharisee and the publican for the modern world, or for us today? What would be a world overturning story, or a story that threw away some of our most cherished maps and gave us a new vision of relationships with God, relationships with people? For instance, what would the temple map be? Or what's your temple map, your sacred map? Who would the two people be? Thought about this? Where might they be?
I was thinking the Pharisee might be our politicians right now. I thank God I'm not greedy and dishonest like the rest of us.
Okay, and Jesus would say to him that he's not justified if he lost right. The election.
There's something of a parable in a man who once was president of the United States going out now and building houses for the homeless. Mm-hmm. Jimmy Carter. Mm-hmm.
What are you thinking of? Mm-hmm. Now, this story reminds me of something really interesting that happened to about a year ago. My mother and I went to hear a sermon by Jeb Magruder. Do you remember him?
Mm-hmm.
From the Watergate era?
Oh, yeah.
He was converted in prison. And he's now the head pastor of the First Presbyterian Church in Lexington, Kentucky. So my mother and I went to hear him preach. He preached a sermon on Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus, the tax collector, who is converted and, you know, gives back, tries to make reparations to those that he has defrauded. He never said, you know, I thought of myself as Zacchaeus, but the parallels were absolutely amazing. And he helped me to see the whole position of a tax collector in the Roman Empire. That they were hated by the Romans. You know, the Romans were just using these Jews to collect taxes from their fellow countrymen. And the Jews, of course, hated the tax collectors because they were defrauding them and working for the enemy. So that the tax collector was a very lonely, alienated individual in that culture. And as he began to talk about this, he suggested, I mean, this was a very long and intricate sermon, well thought out, delivered from the heart. I went skeptical, I must admit. When I got out of there, I thought, maybe this man really was converted. But one of the things he said was that people who act as lackeys of the government, which is sort of what he did, he wasn't collecting taxes, but he was a pawn. The things that were done in the Watergate scandal helped to increase the cynicism in our time for youth and for other people. And that was a profound insight from a man who was involved in that kind of scandal. So he had been parabled in some way. Now, if you can't tell parables, it's hard to think up an original story, I think. Sometimes you can be parables for other people. I don't know if that's happened to you, or have people been parables for you? Jan was talking yesterday about personal parables. I can think of people whose actions have been symbolic in some way, or whose stories have turned me around, challenged my assumptions in some way. That's happened to me often.
Yeah. Well, our generation has seen many mighty people brought low. Hitler, Mussolini, and many political figures. I think in our lifetime we've seen that.
I guess I would think that there's another angle to it. A lot of media reporting is like Pharisees too. They act as if, not all, but many of them act as if they are God himself speaking because they know the truth.
Well, do we get the media we deserve sometimes?
I think we ask for a lot of it, right? We want all the dirt.
It's very easy for us to, having made gods of technology, to look upon anything that comes to us through technology as speaking the truth. It's very hard not to feel that way. And besides which, media performances, I've been a journalist, so I know sort of what's behind the scenes. They're very smooth. A newspaper article reads right along, nothing goes wrong on the news, and you don't realize how much construction of the news there is, how much trimming and putting together, and this is all theater and a lot of fiction. You don't get very much news from the news, frankly. There was a hand in the back. Harold, is that you?
Yeah, I think we have to be awful careful looking at others and not start looking at us.
Thanks.
Start looking at ourselves. We take ultimate pride in how many services we go to and prayer meeting and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And we have to be awful careful with that, looking around and saying, well, we're not Pharisee-like people. We really need to look inward at our structure and our activities and our habits. In our community, there's the Church of the Good Shepherd. And I'm just amazed at all the work these people do for the hungry and homeless in Wilmington, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And these people do it 7 days a week, 14 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish I could measure mm-hmm. up and do some of that.
Mm-hmm.
I do other things, but I've never gone that far.
Mm-hmm. That's the sort of a way of being like a Pharisee in the best sense.
Yeah.
Pharisee was to study the law day and night.
Yeah.
Do we do that? Do we put it into action? The reason I mentioned Jeb Magruder was not just because of the tax collector connection, but he is involved in that Jimmy Carter housing project very much in that church. I mean, they have some good social programs. That might be his way of making his reparations. Yeah.
When you mentioned Magruder, it made me think of that whole Watergate mess. I listened to Chuck Colson say that when his father got the story from the newspapers when Watergate broke. His father called him up. He said, I don't want to know what the newspapers are saying. I already know that. And he said, I don't care what you say unless it's the truth.
Yeah.
And that's when he decided that he had to tell the truth, he said, and he has. And now he's working through the prison ministry. Doing so much good. So that's another example. There he had his office next door to the Oval Office and was in a seat of power, so to speak, and was brought down to
having to serve time in prison.
Yeah. Prison can be a parable, I suppose, for people. How many people identify with both the Pharisee and the publican?
I think you can.
I was a Pharisee, then I became a publican, then God saved me. It's almost like a narrative here.
And then in the pulpit area, there's a couple, Jimmy Baker and...
Let's move on to this next segment to talk about what it means to read and immigrate. This is a phrase from someone I'm going to read something to you about. There's a church in Manhattan that has an inscription over the door that says, "The world is made not out of atoms, but out of stories. Not out of atoms, but out of stories." From birth, actually before birth, to death and beyond, we all live in stories. We tell stories, stories about ourselves and other people, the stories that others tell about us as well, before we're born, as well as after we die. We live in stories throughout our lives. Narratives of all kinds help to give us a sense of reality, to make sense of our experience. They plot our lives in time. They give us faces to put on, identities to act out, futures to expect, memories to look back at. And each of us has at least one story about who we are. It kind of sums up who we are. I remember my nephew, little Willie. When he was 6 years old, he was quarreling with his cousin John Paul, and John Paul was giving him a really hard time. John Paul's very funny and feisty. And finally, Willie bumped his rotund tummy up against his cousin, and he said, "Don't you fight with me, I'm nice." Seemed like a very grown-up thing to say. I somehow, that rang a bell. And actually, Willie grew up to be a very nice person. Whereas John Paul has always been kind of a problem. And his ambition now, he's in college, his ambition is to become a movie star. And John Paul is knocked down dead gorgeous. He would stop traffic. He is so beautiful. So maybe he'll make it as a movie star. But that reminded me that a lot of the stories that we have about ourselves, we get from other places. We don't just tell stories to ourselves. It's very hard to be original, think of an absolutely totally original story. What we usually do is put together other stories and make our own combination of them. But where do we get the stories about ourselves? Stories about our culture, our race, our class, who we are as women, as men, as mothers, as daughters. Stories about who's a winner, who's not, who's successful, who's not. All of those stories that make up our thinking, our world. Where do you get those from?
Hopefully it starts at home.
Right. From parents?
It should start there.
Right. Experience.
Experience, all right.
Mm-hmm. Observation of friends and others.
Okay. Not to be smart, but do you think that story could have come from Manhattan, Kansas, instead of Manhattan?
I saw it in New York.
No, but I think there's a parable there. We many times think of those important things as happening at those familiar places, yeah. But they happen at the unfamiliar places, right. In big ways, too.
That's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. Well, every time I come out west, I think about regional myths. You all have sort of, especially if you're from a region, you have a kind of myth about it. And about the time I moved from Chicago to the New York area, this Steinberg cartoon came out, which you've all seen by now, many versions of it have been made, in which New York is very much, you know, in the forefront of the horizon, big and gorgeous and glittery, and then the rest of the country drops off real quick. You know? So this is a map. And then there's the Mississippi and threads along the horizon way back there, the monument that goes to Chicago. And you don't see much of Manhattan. Kansas isn't in there at all. And the coastline of, you kind of see San Francisco way out there in the distance. The West has its own versions of this kind of regional myth. I saw another New Yorker cartoon a little while ago in which there's a highway threading into the forest, into the mountains and forest. and a sign by the highway says, "You are now entering God's country. Next secular area, 285 miles. And here we are in Golden, right? This reminds me of Mircea Eliade is a comparative religionist who talks about sacred and profane space. And sacred space is where you are. It's where our village is, our nation, our tribe, our group, and where God is. Sacred space is reality. Profane space is out there. It's out west. It's out east. It's not only bad space, it isn't real. It's not reality. It doesn't exist. There's one reason why exile, banishment, is such a terrible punishment in the ancient world, because you were being banished to nowhere, you know, where God wasn't, where reality wasn't. Sacred and profane space. We need all kinds of stories. Regional myths are one kind of story in order to make sense of our existence. And problematically, though, many of these stories are invisible to us. We don't realize, not all our stories are good ones. And we don't realize that they structure our thinking the way we do. I know, you know, all kinds of people, not excluding myself, who have or have had self-images that are not true. And every now and then, something happens to jolt you into realizing that the story you've been living in is not true. We all go through this. This is the process of growing up, isn't it? And these events are like your personal parables, if you know how to read them, if you have ears and eyes. And one of the reasons we're talking about this is to sensitize us to those moments in our life, and also to offer the promise that we can get through those difficult cruxes because God is working through our lives. The ethicists Stanley Hauerwas and Stephen Burrell talk about the myths that we live in. And they say that even well-intentioned people trying to make sense of their lives can fall into delusion. We're only human, I guess you might say. And we want order. It's one of the reasons for stories. We want order. We want things to hang together. We want things to make sense. We want to assure ourselves, especially, that we're nice and that good is going to triumph. And that doesn't always happen right away. So the stories we need most are the stories that help us to find reality, or that find reality in us, rather than false stories. The New Testament talks about, let's see if I can make this thing work. Biblos mythos. Old wives' tales is one of the interpretations of this, I think, but profane stories, as opposed to logoi, true stories. Now, Randy, of course, we connect this immediately to Jesus as logos, right? But I didn't capitalize it yet. In Greek, I read the other day that this is often translated fables. So here we are back at parable, telling us reality. You can get reality through a fiction in a parable, right? So how do we find true stories? Well, I wanted to share with you something from this book, which I tried to get ordered at the bookstore, and unfortunately it's not in print at the moment, but surely it will be soon again. Morning Light, the Spiritual Journal of Jean Sullivan, a very interesting writer. He was a Jesuit priest who asked his bishop to be released from his priestly duties so he could go to Paris and write. He's French. And he went to, and his bishop gave him his blessings. He had a very gifted priest. And he went to Paris and wrote a string of novels, some of which are now being translated into English. And one of them is The Sea Remains, which I've ordered at the bookstore, which will come in eventually, maybe not in your time, but you might want to read it sometime, because it's a very parabolic story about a Christ-like figure who is a parable to others and a parable to us. But in Morning Light, he reflects on parables. And I wanted to share with you some things he says. How do we find true stories? Sullivan says, to read is to emigrate. He explains, school and society as a whole fail to teach us how to read. I know that's true. I'm a reading teacher sometimes. And it's difficult, and we don't always do it the right way. He says, they teach us to hold on and grab. Books that answer the need for nostalgia, another kind of reading, or merely offer knowledge, can be read only with the intention of staying put. The armchair traveler. The gospel, however, plunges us into the openness of the instant. It is the book of rebellion. To read it is to be born elsewhere. To read is to emigrate. The spiritual person expresses himself through paradox, humor, and parable. He becomes, in turn, ironic, enigmatic, a killjoy. Jesus the killjoy. Be prepared if you want to be a parable to someone else, to be a killjoy. Sometimes, maybe you need to be. Jesus is the unknowingly decide that we've arrived when we've scarcely begun the journey. Parable and paradox, on the other hand, keep the message at a distance, slowing down our comprehension. They block automatic reactions and raise questions. Unless there is an effort to turn oneself inside out, the gospel is reduced to mere information. That's why things are said in parables, so that the person who thinks he understands won't understand at all. The point is to be understood, to be rid of all self-importance. The Pharisee. Jesus himself now, this constant tramping and crossing frontiers, heralds other departures, other journeys, which will carry the gospel beyond Palestine. It's always a matter of being uprooted. Be not afraid. The whole thrust of the Bible has been in the same direction since Abraham. Exi, E-X-I, set out. Every church will always be invited to give up its place. How do you like that? Building a new church, and you hear that? Every church will be invited to give up its place, its self-importance. If I don't go away, Jesus says, the Spirit will not come. Sullivan repeats that over and over in his journal. I mean, in some ways, he was kind of an exile, alone in Paris writing, not working with his order. And also, he was very disaffected with the Roman Catholic Church. And when he went to Paris, got away from the usual duties, he began to read the Bible all over again, which is one reason why this journal is exciting to me. He has interesting things to say about the Bible. He says, if I don't go away, Jesus says, the Spirit will not come. Emigrate. Go out. So Jesus' word touches you like a hand on the shoulder, a threat as well as a friendship, a fraternal and dangerous invitation that leads from the known world and the deciphered text, the Bible we think we know, and makes you cross over into a land that is elsewhere, that leads also here. It's elsewhere and here, an image you carry deep inside of you. The kingdom is within, as well as beyond and in the future. Now, having sort of bridged that, let's talk about parable. This is the Good Samaritan story, as you may have guessed.
I have a question. Please.
Yes, indeed.
In there, someplace when you're reading it, I think it said that we'd never be able to understand fully a parable. It always escapes you.
Yeah,
is that? Well, I'm not sure that's what it said, but I'm just wondering, if does that mean that if, let's say, it went to 20 pastors gave a sermon in succession about the parable of the Good Samaritan, not any one of those would be, none of those would be the actual. I still have to interpret that in my mind. In other words, there's always kind of, there's more in there than we can find out. Did it say that may be true.
I think what he was saying was that the parable puts you through a kind of crux, a crisis, in which suddenly you realize you don't understand at all.
Yeah.
To challenge your understanding of your world. I think that's what he means.
But does that mean?
It doesn't mean you don't get anything out of it in the end.
No, I didn't mean that. I'm just saying that the mightiest pastor in the biggest church is also maybe still wrestling with that parable. Mm-hmm. Is that true?
Sure, that's possible.
Okay.
But, you know, I think the parables are for us, and not just for us to hear pastors tell us about them.
Yeah.
Right, Jan?
Yes, ma'am. Okay. That's why as a pastor, you can study a text for hundreds of years, and every time you study it, you come up with something new.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, ever changing, ever new. Uh-huh. And I think that that's the why it is considered in terms of gospel to be the Word of God, because it's something that's totally revealing God's self to us, wherever we may be along our journey.
Okay.
I mean, one reason for this, too, is that the parables are told in situations. And each time the situation changes, and it's different for us and for Jesus, and it's different for you tomorrow. And for me next year. I studied these parables about 10 years ago last time. Boy, they're different now. So that's part of the wonder of those parables, is that they can continually speak to the situations. They're meant to be used in situations. So
they haven't changed, though, have they?
You think you got it wrong the first time?
Huh?
You think you got it wrong?
No, you've grown.
No.
You just missed something?
Your experience.
We've changed, but they haven't.
It's possible you missed something, but you change and you grow. Sometimes people shrink.
In other
words, have to be grown back up again.
The opposite of that would be that if it isn't different for you 10 years from now, you're stuck.
Huh? That's possibly true. Yeah. I mean, Holden is kind of measured for me of that. Every time I come up here, you know, a few more years have come by, is the time to take stock. How has the experience changed each time?
That's it. I think the word experience, because tomorrow, today's experience may impact on what you're going to need tomorrow.
Uh-huh.
In a parable, I may open your vista again. Mm-hmm. Maybe I don't express it very well, but...
No, you hold on to that wisdom. And then another situation might open up that parable again for you.
Exactly.
Good Samaritan stories in Luke 10, 25 to 37. This is very much situated. In a dialogue with someone else. And this dialogue is very important. And behold, a lawyer stood up to put him to the test, saying, "Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life?" And this guy is a scribe, I assume. Scribes were deeply versed in the law. They copied manuscripts. They studied the Torah, they lectured on it, they went on lecture tours, they were often on the road. A scribe would work with the priesthood, but he also shared the life of everyday people. And here he's talking to Jesus as a rabbi, master. "What must I do to inherit eternal life?" He said to him, "What is written in the law? How do you read?" So Jesus doesn't answer his question, he throws it back at him. And he answered, he knows the law. "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself." Okay, he's got it down. He knows it by heart. And he said to him, "You have answered right. Do this and you will live." So Jesus really doesn't answer his question at all. In a way, he lets him answer his own question. He says, "Yeah, that's it. I'll do that." Well, that's not the end of the story, is it? But he, desiring to justify himself, this is Luke putting this in, I think, but anyway, he said to Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" Second question. This time, Jesus answers with a story. A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he fell among robbers who stripped him and beat him and departed, leaving him half dead. Now, by chance, a priest was going down that road, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. So likewise, a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he journeyed, came to where he was, and when he saw him, he had compassion, and went to him and bound up his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he set him on his own beast and brought him to an inn and took care of him. And the next day he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper, saying, "Take care of him, and whatever more you spend, I will repay you when I come back." Now Jesus says, "Which of these three do you think proved neighbor to the man who fell among the robbers?" So now he asks his own question. And what else can the lawyer say? The one who showed mercy on him. And Jesus said to him, as he said before, "Go and do that likewise." very symmetrical story and has that interesting framework where Jesus throws back the question and then tells a story and then at the end reframes the question to get the answer. Why does this lawyer need a parable? If he knows the law, why does he need a parable?
He needs to make the law human.
Okay. Which is what the parables, the Meshalim, were about. To make the Torah bearable and understandable. So in that sense, Jesus is operating within his own tradition. Why did this lawyer need a parable? This guy.
Well, he was testing Jesus, and Jesus is not to be tested.
Let's not believe that for a minute. Let's assume that Luke really didn't know this man's motives. That makes it too easy to dismiss him as a villain or something. But why did he need a parable? Why did Jesus feel he needed a parable? If Jesus thought he was a villain, why would he even bother with him? Just walk off, you know.
I think he didn't understand the meaning of the word, quote, love, unquote. I mean, that's what Jesus was trying to get across.
Okay. Well, Jesus was a teacher, too, and it says the man stood up, so obviously there was a group of people. And it may have been, I'm not saying it was, but it might have been to take the example of this lawyer and through the parable then to show the lesson to the rest of the people that were there.
All right, there's always a larger audience, or almost always.
And sometimes you teach for the larger audience as well as for the individual.
That's right, you do.
This might throw you way off track, but a lot of law is set on precedent. And Christ, or Jesus, was giving the lawyer a precedent or something to work from or with.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think that's reasonable. You know, how do you apply this now to a situation? Mm-hmm. Case law?
Mm-hmm. Perhaps Jesus' motive here was to try to, for the lawyer to internalize this, because mm-hmm. being a professional person, it was probably pretty easy for him to use the examples very objectively.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't internalize it into
mm-hmm.
himself.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, I was brought up a Lutheran, and you know, studied the Bible from the beginning of time. My life was immersed in it, and I often feel that's kind of a disadvantage because the stuff became so familiar, and I could throw it around, and it takes life to make that more meaningful to you after years and years of having heard it over and over again. One of the reasons he needs to have a parable is when he asks, who is my neighbor, there's an implied other question there, isn't there? Who is not my neighbor? And there was, in fact, debate during that time about what neighbor meant. And generally, the Jews agreed that neighbor meant fellow countrymen, but they disagreed about the exceptions. Pharisees felt that non-Pharisees were not neighbors. There was a popular saying that ruled out personal enemies. They're not neighbors. And there was, in fact, a rabbinical saying that said, heretics, informers, and renegades should be pushed into the ditch and not pulled out. So there was some debate about that. But the main reason we can see here is that this man knows the law, but he hasn't yet learned how to interpret the law for human life. That's why Jesus doesn't just ask him, what says the law? Then he asks a second question, how do you read? And that is the key issue, isn't it, for people who've grown up in the church. How do you read? Yes?
When did the concept of the eternal life come in the Jewish teaching?
I'm not an expert on that, but it around the time of Jesus, that became more important to the Pharisees, as far as I know.
But in the Old Torah, there wasn't the...
No, that's a much later idea. Mm-hmm. I would guess it's associated with the situation of domination in the Roman Empire. Okay. Things don't look so good now in the present. This is the only parable I think I'm going to do a structural analysis of, but I just want to point out a couple things. One of the things I've learned in studying biblical storytelling is how ritualized it is and how important it is to pay attention to the language, and here I have to rely on biblical scholars who know Hebrew really well and can tell me what, how the Hebrew does it. They seem like such simple, naive stories anyone could tell them, but they're always very intricately constructed and very cleverly and sophisticatedly constructed. In this case, you've got a series of parallel incidents with subject, verb, and some other things that parallel these people. A certain man going down, da-da-da-da-da, and then the robbers, they went away. Okay? The audience that Jesus was speaking to would assume the man in the ditch was a Jew, unless they were told otherwise. Just like we often assume that, you know, something is about Americans, unless we're told otherwise. Then the next, so that presents a problem. Now we have three responses. A certain priest going down, da-da-da-da, and seeing he went by. Now in this case, what's set up here in the syntax of the sentence is a subtle parallelism. The priest and the man in the ditch are parallel, right? In the way the sentence is set up. They're both going down that road. In fact, had it occurred to you that if that priest was there 10 minutes before or half an hour before, he might have been the one in the ditch? They're both going down the road. And but the priest is a priest. He has a title. He has, you know, he belongs on the map. The man in the ditch has no clothes. He has no form of identification. He's a completely anonymous victim. Anybody passing by on the road couldn't tell if he was, you know, what country, what village he belonged to or anything. He's a completely anonymous victim. And so by, you know, the priest is definitely in a higher position. Literally, he's walking the law, and also socially and religiously. And seeing, he sees. He does see, but he went by. This part of the sentence parallels him with the robbers. They went away. He went by. He went away. So this priest is in a way, he's no different from the man in the ditch, except he was just lucky, right? And he's doing, by deliberate choice, what the robbers did, in a sense, leaving the man to die. Then we have a certain Levite going down and seeing he went by. So he's paralleled in those same ways. Now, the audience in Jesus' time knew so many stories that operated in threes. You know, we have the three little pigs, and we have other stories that have three characters. So the expectations of the audience so far would be that there's going to be a third person, and maybe something's going to happen. And in the standard division of the Israel, of the Jewish people, you have priests, Levites, and Israelites, and meaning, you know, priests, Levites, and Israelite laymen. So the third person they expect is going to be an Israelite layman, and certainly not a Samaritan. Now this man, stripped and wounded, left half dead, is lying there, the anonymous victim, the priest and the Levite are going by. The Samaritan comes up and he went, again, that word, up to him, different direction. And seeing, once again, have pity. So the reversal happens here. And then there's a whole string of actions. Did you hear me reading that? It was just one thing after another. That was a long sentence. There were a lot of things that he did. And Jesus dwells on that in the parable, giving you time to take in what this man has done. Now, at this point, I'm going to ask you why you think the Levite and the priest passed by. I know, because they're bad people, and Levites and priests, you know, we have these very negative ideas about priests and Levites, and Jews in general, and Christianity, and we just have to try and get rid of that and think about why they might have passed by. I will live their choice. Yes, maybe they were hard-hearted, but let's try to think of some other reasons.
How about the clean, unclean possibility?
Well, how does that play in?
Well, they mustn't touch anything unless it's cleansed.
Anything at all?
Well,
what about a man in a ditch?
That's, well, the man may be viewed as being questionably unclean.
Now, the road to Jericho was famous for robbers. It was a very dangerous road, and lots of rocks robbers could hide behind. And one reason they might have passed by the other side, they're afraid the robbers are waiting to get them. You know, that would be a good robber trick. Highwaymen.
Are they Jewish? Also, huh? Are the priest and the Levite are Jewish?
Yes.
Is that right?
Right.
Well, the priests all come from the Levite tribe.
But the Levites are like the servants of the priests. You know, they don't, as I said before, they don't go into the Holy of Holies. There's a hierarchy in that priest-Levite labor in Jewish thought. That's another kind of social mapping. But getting back to what you said, that road from Jerusalem to Jericho might have been taken in realistic, you know, realistic terms by a priest and a Levite going from Jerusalem, where they might have done their temple duties, up to Jericho, where many priests and Levites lived. And so they would have been ritually purified themselves and would not have wanted to touch a corpse, because this man's been left half dead. That detail is important. He looks like he might be dead, and they don't go close enough to find out. And they probably wouldn't want to touch him anyway. So there is that possibility. They want to avoid ritual uncleanness, in which case they are perfectly within, you know, doing their duty. Just like that Pharisee in the temple, you know, saying his prayer. Now there's a little argument against this, in that in the Mishnah, in the oral law, there were in fact discussions of situations that didn't come in Leviticus, where that law of purity is set down. And in fact, one of the things that the Mishnah says is that a priest is not allowed to defile himself. If one of his relatives dies, he can't go home and bury them. It's even his mother, because that would make him unclean. But he might contact uncleanness because of a neglected corpse. A neglected corpse would be somebody lying on the side of the road who can't speak out, who has no one to help him. And this is that kind of case, exactly. And there are a number of these instances in the Mishnah, and they're about sort of what happens to priests when they're on journeys. You know, when you go on a journey, you get into trouble.
Well, then there's the personality of the man himself.
Okay.
He might have been a very selfish individual.
That's right. That's possible, sure. So the ritual purity thing doesn't necessarily get him off the hook. We don't know if these are Sadducees or Pharisees. If they're Sadducees, they would have followed Leviticus, and they would have been perfectly within their understanding of religion to walk by. But if they're Pharisees, they would have paid more attention to the oral law, as I understand this, and that wouldn't have been an excuse. Now, what's the audience thinking at this point? Well, if there are priests and Levites in the audience, they're going to approve, presumably. The Pharisee is going to think, gee, my tradition is superior to that of the Sadducees in the story. If it's a peasant, you know, there probably were some peasants listening to the story. A peasant might have thought, how like the priests, you know? They're so separate, they're so superior. And the peasant would have been, you know, rubbing his hands, waiting for a layman to come and show them up. Now, the problem is that, you know, the person who comes and shows them up is a Samaritan. Now, that is a totally surprising detail. It doesn't make even, you know, linguistic sense. It's like saying a bishop, a priest, and a Frenchman. Not a three pair. But why especially would the Samaritan be a shocking figure to turn up here?
He wasn't accepted by the Jewish people. He was an outcast.
Why were the Samaritans so unpopular?
Well, they're not the whole
Jewish. Not
the
Jewish.
They're not whole. The other
they're half-breeds. And they've been half-breeds for hundreds of years. For 700 years since the Assyrians came in and mixed up all those peoples in northern Israel and imported other nationalities.
They're pariah.
They're a pariah. They were a rich, it's a rich country up there. And so that area had been plundered and conquered and trampled upon. In many ways, the Samaritans were in the ditch culturally. Also, the Samaritans were closer to Greece, so they were thought of as worldly and materialistic. And there were a number of incidents that these people and the story Jesus would have known about. When the Israelites came back to establish a temple at Jerusalem, they set up their rules of purity again, and Samaritans offered to help rebuild the temple, and they were refused. and so they built their own. So they were also a sect, a sort of a Jewish sect up there in Samaria. So they were socially separate, religiously separate, geographically separate, economically separate. There was a saying in Jewish lore that he who eats the bread of the Samaritans is like to one who eats the flesh of swine. Mm-hmm. The Samaritans are the pigs. There are pigs in these stories. Anyway, right earlier in Luke, Jesus had sent his messengers into a Samaritan village to prepare his way to Jerusalem. And his messengers had been rejected by those Samaritans. And James and John said, Jesus, what should we do? Should we call upon heaven to drop fire on that village like Elijah? And Jesus said, you don't know what spirit you're of, he said. For the Son of Man is not come to destroy people's lives, but to save them. So they just use another image. So the idea of good Samaritan is an unsayable word. It's like saying the good terrorist. Or for some people, the good black woman. It's a contradiction. And even the lawyer at the end, you'll notice, he doesn't say, when Jesus asks him, who is neighbor? He doesn't say the Samaritan. He says, he who showed mercy on him. He can't even say that word. He's still standing back at some point. The good Samaritan is unsayable. Now think about the identification issues here. Jew listening to this story, if he wants to be the hero of the story, all right? We all want to be the heroes of the stories we read. I think that's kind of in human nature. He can't identify with the priest and the Levite because they've been discredited, and besides, he may not be one, may not be able to identify with them anyway. If he identifies with the man in the ditch, then he's certainly not the hero. He's, you know, in a half-dead position and has to accept the compassion of his hated enemy. But he can't identify with Samaritan either. So the whole story becomes a question, not so much who is my neighbor, but who am I? And Jesus turns this around at the end, so the question is not about the object of mercy, but the subject. He says to the lawyer, who was neighbor? Right? Not who is my neighbor, but who was neighbor? Obviously the point of this is that the Samaritans are your neighbors and you are theirs. In rabbinic storytelling, there are a lot of stories about helping underdogs. And that's, you know, a standard thing in tradition. I'm going to share one of these with you, I hope, on Saturday. And so if Jesus were writing or doing his parable speaking in that tradition, what he would do is tell a story about a Jew helping a Samaritan. Right? And then the answer would be, well, who is my neighbor? The one who fell among thieves. But in this story, Jews do not help Samaritans. A Samaritan helps a Jew. So it really turns things around. It's some very interesting ones. Any comments before we sort of quit for today about this story?
I think we still have to deal with this parable today.
Yes.
Because in so many cases, we may see someone who needs help when we're on the highway, that we're afraid to stop.
Imply it literally.
Afraid to stop. In some cases we do help, but in some cases we don't, just for that fear. And this always comes to my mind when I pass someone up, and I'm on the highway.
And there are ways to help without putting yourself in complete jeopardy. And I'm a single woman, and I do not do just anything in all situations. But I think one of the tendencies is to apply this very literally. I mean, this was Dickens' favorite parable. And he applied it very literally. Oliver Twist, lying in a ditch. Here come the Maylies, or whatever their name is, this happy Christian family, and they pick him up off the street and bring him in their home. I mean, and then they bring him in the home, Dickens pictures of the Samaritan painting on over their fireplace. But I think we have to think about the challenge of this, too, to our own cultural maps. That's one of the things I wanted to emphasize.
I think one of the things it may speak to in a very subtle way is the whole issue of racism.
Sure does. There are geographical divisions here. There are social and economic divisions between these characters. Political divisions. racial divisions. Let me give you an assignment so we can quit. I would like to ask you to think about this parable and how it could be translated into modern terms so that it makes the hearer emigrate, leave home, experience something about himself and about the world that changes his view of the world. As in the case of a lawyer listening to this parable who suddenly realizes that the Samaritan is neighbor and his neighbor.
Now, what's the actual question you want us to do?
I would like you to think up a new parable. Based on this basic structure, if you like, you have three people, it doesn't have to be highway, but see if you can come up with a new story for a modern world. And it, and the best kind would be a story for yourself rather than for somebody else. You can do that, yes.
I think we need to slow down. I think the priest and the Levite sometimes were in a hurry, and with our pace of living,
yes,
this is something that I need to look at time and time again. I need to slow down and see what's going on around me.
We're very absorbed.
Observe and take action on what I'm seeing.
That's what the map does to us. It channels us, you know, in one direction. So, you know, talk about it with other people at lunch or wherever, and see if you can think of another kind of story. Maybe not a whole story. Maybe you can only come up with part of the story or some of the characters. That's good enough, and we could develop it next time. Yes.
This is the only day where you're going to have back-to-back parable sessions, and I'm really concerned that that's an awful overkill for this morning in terms of time. What I'd like to do is just let you go, and if you'll listen for the bell, I'll give you a good 15, 20-minute break.
Oh,
so you have some time to go out, throw out all this stuff, get yourself ready for it.